a consistent finding throughout the decades. Dietary fat and obesity. The evidence on a link between dietary fat and obesity is consistent. There is no association whatsoever. The main concern about dietary fats had always been heart disease. Obesity concerns were just thrown in as well. When dietary fat was declared a villain, cognitive dissonance set in. Dietary carbohydrates could not be good because they are low in fat and bad because they are fattening at the same time. Without anybody even noticing, it was decided that carbohydrates were no longer fattening. Calories were fattening. Dietary fat, with its high caloric density, must therefore be bad for weight gain as well. However, there was never any data to support this assumption. Even the National Cholesterol Education Program admits the percentage of total fat in the diet, independent of caloric intake, has not been documented to be related to body weight. Translation: despite 50 years of trying to prove that dietary fat causes obesity, we still cannot find any evidence. This data is hard to find because it never existed. A comprehensive review of all the studies of high-fat dairy finds no association with obesity, with whole milk, sour cream, and cheese offering greater benefits than low-fat dairy. Eating fat does not make you fat, but may protect you against it. Eating fat together with other foods tends to decrease glucose and insulin spikes. If anything, dietary fat would be expected to protect against obesity. While literally thousands of papers have reviewed this data, perhaps Dr. Walter Willett of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health said it best in his 2002 review article entitled, "Dietary fat plays a major role in obesity." No. Considered one of the world's foremost experts in nutrition, he writes, "Diets high in fat do not account for the high prevalence of excess body fat in Western countries. Reductions in the percentage of energy from fat will have no important benefits and could further exacerbate this problem. The emphasis on total fat reduction has been a serious distraction in efforts to control obesity and improve health in general." The failure of the low-fat paradigm was fully exposed in the Women's Health Initiative Dietary Modification Trial. Nearly 50,000 women were randomly assigned to low-fat or regular diets. Over 7 years, the low-fat, calorie-restricted diet produced no benefits in weight loss. Nor were there heart protection benefit either. The incidence of cancer, heart disease, or stroke was not reduced. There were no cardiovascular benefits. There were no weight benefits. The low-fat diet was a complete failure. The emperor had no clothes. Part 6. The Solution. Chapter 19. What to Eat. There are two prominent findings from all the dietary studies done over the years. First, all diets work. Second, all diets fail. What do I mean? Weight loss follows the same basic curve so familiar to dieters. Whether it is the Mediterranean, the Atkins, or even the old-fashioned low-fat, low-calorie, all diets in the short term seem to produce weight loss. Sure, they differ by amount lost, some a little more, some a little less, but they all seem to work. However, by 6 to 12 months, weight loss plateaus, followed by a relentless regain, despite continued dietary compliance. In the 10-year diabetes prevention program, for example, there was a 15.4-pound, 7-kilogram weight loss after 1 year. The dreaded plateau, then weight regain, followed. So, all diets fail. The question is, why? Permanent weight loss is actually a two-step process. There is a short-term and a long-term, or time-dependent, problem. The hypothalamic region of the brain determines the body set weight, the fat thermostat. For more on body set weight, refer to chapters 6 and 10. Insulin acts here to set body set weight higher. In the short term, we can use various diets to bring our actual body weight down. However, once it falls below the body set weight, the body activates mechanisms to regain that weight, and that's the long-term problem. This resistance to weight loss has been proven both scientifically and empirically. Obese persons that had lost weight required fewer calories because their metabolisms had slowed dramatically and desire to eat accelerates. The body actively resists long-term weight loss. The multifactorial nature of disease. The multifactorial nature of obesity is the crucial missing link. There is no one single cause of obesity. Do calories cause obesity? Yes, partially. Do carbohydrates cause obesity? Yes, partially. Does fiber protect us from obesity? Yes, partially. Does insulin resistance cause obesity? Yes, partially. Does sugar cause obesity? Yes, partially. Refer to chapter 17, figure 17.2. All these factors converge on several hormonal pathways that lead to weight gain, and insulin is the most important of these. Low-carbohydrate diets reduce insulin. Low-calorie diets restrict all foods and therefore reduce insulin. Paleo and LCHF diets, low in refined and processed foods, reduce insulin. Cabbage soup diets reduce insulin. Reduced food reward diets reduce insulin. Virtually all diseases of the human body are multifactorial. Consider cardiovascular disease, family history, age, gender, smoking, high blood pressure, and physical activity all influence, perhaps not equally, the development of heart disease. Cancer, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, and chronic renal failure are all multifactorial diseases. Obesity is also a multifactorial disease. What we need is a framework, a structure, a coherent theory to understand how all its factors fit together. Too often, our current model of obesity assumes that there is only one single true cause, and that all others are pretenders to the throne. Endless debates ensue. Too many calories cause obesity. No, too many carbohydrates. No, too much saturated fat. No, too much red meat. No, too much processed foods. No, too much high-fat dairy. No, too much wheat. No, too much sugar. No, too much highly palatable foods. No, too much eating out. It goes on and on. They are all partially correct. So the low-calorie believers disparage the LCHF people. The LCHF movement ridicules the vegans. The vegans mock the paleo supporters. The paleo followers deride the low-fat devotees. All diets work because they all address a different aspect of the disease. But none of them work for very long because none of them addresses the totality of the disease. Without understanding the multifactorial nature of obesity, which is critical, we are doomed to an endless cycle of blame. Most dietary trials are fatally flawed by this tunnel vision. Trials comparing low-carb to low-calorie diets have all asked the wrong question. These two diets are not mutually exclusive. What if both are valid? Then there should be similar weight loss on both sides. Low-carb diets lower insulin. Lowering insulin levels reduces obesity. However, all foods raise insulin to some degree. Since refined carbohydrates often make up 50% or more of the standard American diet, low-calorie diets generally result in a reduced carbohydrate intake. So, low-calorie diets, by restricting the total amount of food consumed, still work to lower insulin levels. Both will work, at least in the short term. That is exactly what Harvard professor Dr. Frank Sachs confirmed in his randomized study of four different diets. Despite differences in carbohydrate, fat, and protein content, albeit relatively minor, weight loss was the same. Maximum weight loss occurred at 6 months, with gradual regain thereafter. A 2014 meta-analysis of dietary trials reached much the same conclusion. Weight loss differences between individual diets were minimal. Sure, sometimes one diet comes off as slightly better than another. The difference is usually less than 2 pounds, about 1 kilogram, and often fades within a year. Let's face it, we've done low calories, low fat. It didn't work. We've done Atkins too. It didn't produce the effortless weight loss that was promised. Sometimes these results are interpreted to mean that everything can be eaten in moderation, which doesn't even begin to address the complexity of weight gain in humans. Moderation is a cop-out answer, a deliberate attempt to evade the hard work of searching for dietary truths. For example, should we eat broccoli in the same moderation as ice cream? Obviously not. Should we drink milk in the same moderation as sugar-sweetened beverages? Obviously not. The long-recognized truth is that certain foods must be severely restricted, including sugar-sweetened beverages and candy. Other foods do not need to be restricted, kale or broccoli, for instance. Others have erroneously concluded that it's all about calories. Actually, it's nothing of the sort. Calories are only a single factor in the multifactorial disease that is obesity. Let's face the truth. Low-calorie diets have been tried again and again and again. They fail every single time. There are other answers that are not really answers. These include, there is no best diet, or choose the diet that suits you, or the best diet is one you can follow. But if supposed experts in nutrition and disease don't know the right diet, how are you supposed to? Is the standard American diet the best diet for me because it's the one I can follow? Or a diet of sugared cereals and pizza? Obviously not. In cardiovascular disease, for example, choose the treatment that suits you would never be considered satisfactory advice. If the lifestyle factors of stopping smoking and increased physical activity both reduce heart disease, then we would strive to do both rather than try to choose one or the other. We would not say, the best lifestyle for heart disease is the one you can follow. Unfortunately, many so-called experts in obesity profess this exact sentiment. The truth is that there are multiple overlapping pathways that lead to obesity. The common uniting theme is the hormonal imbalance of hyperinsulinemia. For some patients, sugar or refined carbohydrates are the main problem. Low-carbohydrate diets may work best here. For others, the main problem may be insulin resistance. Changing meal timing or intermittent fasting may be most beneficial. For still others, the cortisol pathway is dominant. Stress reduction techniques or correcting sleep deprivation may be critical. Lack of fiber may be the critical factor for yet others. Most diets attack one part of the problem at a time. But why? In cancer treatment, for example, multiple types of chemotherapy and radiation are combined together. The probability of success is much higher with a broad-based attack. In cardiovascular disease, multiple drug treatments work together. We use drugs to treat high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, and smoking cessation all at the same time. Treating high blood pressure does not mean ignoring smoking. In challenging infections such as HIV, a cocktail of different antiviral medicines are combined together for maximum efficacy. The same approach is necessary to address the multidimensional problem of obesity. Instead of targeting a single point in the obesity cascade, we need multiple targets and treatments. We don't need to choose sides. Rather than compare a dietary strategy of, say, low calorie versus low carb, why not do both? There is no reason we can't. It is also important to tailor the approach individually to address the cause of the high insulin levels. For example, if chronic sleep deprivation is the main problem causing weight gain, then decreasing refined grains is not likely to help. If excessive sugar intake is the problem, then mindfulness meditation is not going to be especially useful. Obesity is a hormonal disorder of fat regulation. Insulin is the major hormone that drives weight gain. So the rational therapy is to lower insulin levels. There are multiple ways to achieve this, and we should take advantage of each one. In the rest of this chapter, I will outline a step-by-step approach to accomplish this goal. Step 1. Reduce your consumption of added sugars. Sugar stimulates insulin secretion, but it is far more sinister than that. Sugar is particularly fattening because it increases insulin both immediately and over the long term. Sugar is comprised of equal amounts of glucose and fructose, as discussed in Chapter 14, and fructose contributes directly to insulin resistance in the liver. Over time, insulin resistance leads to higher insulin levels. Therefore, sucrose and high fructose corn syrup are exceptionally fattening, far in excess of other foods. Sugar is uniquely fattening because it directly produces insulin resistance. With no redeeming nutritional qualities, added sugars are usually one of the first foods to be eliminated in any diet. Many natural, unprocessed whole foods contain sugar. For example, fruit contains fructose, and milk contains lactose. Naturally occurring and added sugars are distinct from one another. The two key differences between them are amount and concentration. Obviously, first you should remove your sugar bowl from your table. There is no reason to add sugar to any food or beverage. But sugars are often hidden in the preparation of food, which means that avoiding sugar is often difficult, and you can ingest a surprisingly large amount without knowing it. Sugars are often added to foods during processing or cooking, which presents dieters with several potential pitfalls. First, sugars may be added in unlimited amounts. Second, sugar may be present in processed food in much higher concentrations than in natural foods. Some processed foods are virtually 100% sugar. This condition almost does not exist in natural foods, with honey possibly being the exception. Candy is often little more than flavored sugar. Third, sugar may be ingested by itself, which may cause people to overeat sugary treats, as there is nothing else within the food to make you full. There is often no dietary fiber to help offset the harmful effects. For these reasons, we direct most of our efforts toward reducing added rather than natural sugars in our diet. Read the labels. Almost ubiquitous in refined and processed foods, sugar is not always labeled as such. Other names include sucrose, glucose, fructose, maltose, dextrose, molasses, hydrolyzed starch, honey, invert sugar, cane sugar, glucose fructose, high fructose corn syrup, brown sugar, corn sweetener, rice, corn, cane, maple, malt, golden palm syrup, and agave nectar. These aliases attempt to conceal the presence of large amounts of added sugars. A popular trick is to use several different pseudonyms on the food's label. This trick prevents sugar from being listed as the first ingredient. The addition of sugar to processed foods provides almost magical flavor-enhancing properties at virtually no cost. Sauces are serial offenders. Barbecue, plum, honey garlic, hoisin, sweet and sour, and other dipping sauces contain large amounts of sugar. Spaghetti sauce may contain as much as 10 to 15 grams of sugar, 3 to 4 teaspoons. This counters the tartness of the tomatoes and therefore may not be immediately evident to your taste buds. Commercial salad dressings and condiments such as ketchup and relish often contain lots of sugar. The bottom line is this. If it comes in a package, it probably contains added sugar. Asking how much sugar is acceptable is like asking how many cigarettes are acceptable. Ideally, no added sugar at all would be best, but that probably will not happen. Still, listen to the next section for some reasonable suggestions. What to do about dessert? Most desserts are easily identified and eliminated from your diet. Desserts are mostly sugar with complementary flavors added. Examples include cakes, puddings, cookies, pies, mousses, ice cream, sorbets, candy, and candy bars. So, what can you do about dessert? Follow the example of traditional societies. The best desserts are fresh seasonal fruits, preferably locally grown. A bowl of seasonal berries or cherries with whipped cream is a delicious way to end a meal. Alternatively, a small plate of nuts and cheeses also makes for a very satisfying end to a meal without the burden of added sugars. Dark chocolate, with more than 70% cacao in moderation, is a surprisingly healthy treat. The chocolate itself is made from cocoa beans and does not naturally contain sugar. However, most milk chocolate does contain large amounts of sugar. Dark and semi-sweet chocolate contain less sugar than milk or white varieties. Dark chocolate also contains significant amounts of fiber and antioxidants, such as polyphenols and flavanols. Studies on dark chocolate consumption indicate that it may help reduce blood pressure, insulin resistance, and heart disease. Most milk chocolates, by contrast, are little more than candies. The cacao component is too small to be beneficial. Nuts, in moderation, are another good choice for an after-dinner indulgence. Most nuts are full of healthful monounsaturated fats, have little or no carbohydrates, and are also high in fiber, which increases their potential benefit. Macadamia nuts, cashews, and walnuts can all be enjoyed. Many studies show an association between increased nut consumption and better health, including reducing heart disease and diabetes. Pistachio nuts, high in the antioxidant gamma-tocopherol and vitamins such as manganese, calcium, magnesium, and selenium, are widely eaten in the Mediterranean diet. A recent Spanish study found that adding 100 pistachios to one's daily diet improved fasting glucose, insulin, and insulin resistance. That is not to say that sugar cannot be an occasional indulgence. Food has always played a major role in celebrations, birthdays, weddings, graduations, Christmas, Thanksgiving, etc. The key word here is occasional. Dessert is not to be taken every day. Be aware, though, that if your goal is weight loss, your first major step must be to severely restrict sugar. don't replace sugar with artificial sweeteners, as they also raise insulin as much as sugar and are equally prone to causing obesity. Refer to chapter 15. Just don't snack. The healthy snack is one of the greatest weight loss deceptions. The myth that grazing is healthy has attained legendary status. If we were meant to graze, we would be cows. Grazing is the direct opposite of virtually all food traditions. Even as recently as the 1960s, most people still ate just 3 meals per day. Constant stimulation of insulin eventually leads to insulin resistance. For more on the dangers of snacking, refer to chapters 10 and 11. The solution? Stop eating all the time. Snacks are often little more than thinly disguised desserts. Most contain prodigious amounts of refined flour and sugar. These pre-packaged conveniences have taken over the supermarket shelves. Cookies, muffins, pudding, Jell-O, fruit roll-ups, fruit leather, chocolate bars, cereal bars, granola bars, and biscuits, all are best avoided. Rice cakes, advertising themselves as low-fat, compensate for lack of taste with sugar. Canned or processed fruit conceals buckets of sugar behind the healthy image of the fruit. A serving of Mott's applesauce contains 5.5 teaspoons of sugar, 22 grams. A serving of canned peaches contains 4.5 teaspoons of sugar, 18 grams. Are snacks necessary? No. Simply ask yourself this question. Are you really hungry or just bored? Keep snacks completely out of sight. If you have a snack habit, replace that habit loop with one that is less destructive to your health. Perhaps a cup of green tea in the afternoon should be your new habit. There's a simple answer to the question of what to eat at snack time. Nothing. Don't eat snacks. Period. Simplify your life. Make breakfast optional. Breakfast is, without question, the most controversial meal of the day. The advice to eat something, anything, as soon as you step out of bed is often heard. But breakfast needs to be downgraded from most important meal of the day to meal. Different nations have different breakfast traditions. The big American breakfast contrasts directly with the French petit déjeuner, or small lunch. The key word here is small. The greatest problem is that, like snacks, breakfast foods are often little more than dessert in disguise, containing vast quantities of highly processed carbohydrates and sugar. Breakfast cereals, particularly those that target children, are among the worst offenders. On average, they contain 40% more sugar than those that target adults. Not surprisingly, almost all cereals for children contain sugar, and 10 contain more than 50% sugar by weight. Only 5.5% met the standard for low sugar. In the diets of children under age 8, breakfast cereals rank behind only candy, cookies, ice cream, and sugared drinks as a source of dietary sugar. A simple rule to follow is this. Don't eat sugared breakfast cereal. If you must, eat cereals containing less than 0.8 of a teaspoon, 4 grams of sugar per serving. Many breakfast items from the bakery are also highly problematic. Muffins, cakes, danishes, and banana bread. Not only do they contain significant amounts of refined carbohydrates, they are often sweetened with sugars and jams. Bread often contains sugar and is eaten with sugary jams and jellies. Peanut butter often contains added sugars, too. Traditional and Greek yogurts are nutritious foods. However, commercial yogurts are made with large amounts of added sugars and fruit flavorings. A serving of Yoplait fruit yogurt contains almost 8 teaspoons of sugar, 31 grams. Oatmeal is another traditional and healthy food. Whole oats and steel-cut oats are a good choice, requiring long cooking times because they contain significant amounts of fiber that requires heat and time to break down. Avoid instant oatmeal. It is heavily processed and refined, which allows for instant cooking, and it contains large amounts of added sugar and flavors. Most of the nutritional content is gone. Quaker's flavored instant oatmeal may contain up to 3 1/4 teaspoons of sugar, 13 grams per serving. Instant cream of wheat has the same problem. A single serving contains 4 teaspoons, 16 grams of sugar. While rolled oats and dried fruit, granola and granola bars attempt to disguise themselves as healthy, they are often heavily sugared and contain chocolate chips or marshmallows. Eggs, previously shunned due to cholesterol concerns, can be enjoyed in a variety of ways: scrambled, over easy, sunny side up, hard-boiled, soft-boiled, poached, etc. Egg whites are high in protein, and the yolk contains many vitamins and minerals, including choline and selenium. Eggs are particularly good sources of lutein and zeaxanthin, antioxidants that may help protect against eye problems such as macular degeneration and cataracts. The cholesterol in eggs may actually help your cholesterol profile by changing cholesterol particles to the larger, less atherogenic particles. Indeed, large epidemiologic studies have failed to link increased egg consumption to increased heart disease. Most of all, eat eggs because they are delicious, whole, unprocessed foods. In thinking about what to eat for breakfast, consider this. If you are not hungry, don't eat anything at all. It's perfectly acceptable to break your fast at noon with grilled salmon and a side salad. But there's nothing inherently wrong with eating breakfast in the morning either. It is just like any other meal. However, in the morning rush, many people tend to reach for conveniently prepackaged, heavily processed, and heavily sugared foods. Eat whole, unprocessed foods at all meals, including breakfast. And if you don't have time to eat, then don't eat. Again, simplify your life. Beverages, no sugar added. The sugar-sweetened drink is one of the leading sources of added sugars. This includes all soda pop, sugar-sweetened teas, fruit juice, fruit punch, vitamin water, smoothies, shakes, lemonade, chocolate or flavored milk, iced coffee drinks, and energy drinks. Hot drinks such as hot chocolate, mochaccino, cafe mocha, and sweetened coffee and tea can also be included. Trendy alcoholic drinks add significant amounts of sugar to your diet, including drinks such as hard lemonade, flavored wine coolers, cider beers, as well as more traditional drinks such as Bailey's Irish Cream, margaritas, daiquiris, pina coladas, dessert wines, ice wines, sweet sherries, and liqueurs. What about alcohol itself? Alcohol is made from the fermentation of sugars and starches from various sources. Yeast eat the sugars and convert them to alcohol. Residual sugars result in a sweeter beverage. Sweetened dessert wines are obviously full of sugar and are not recommended. However, moderate consumption of red wine does not raise insulin or impair insulin sensitivity and therefore may be enjoyed. Up to 2 glasses a day is not associated with major weight gain, and many improve insulin sensitivity. The alcohol itself, even from beer, seems to have minimal effect on insulin secretion or insulin resistance. It is sometimes said that you get fat from the foods you eat with the alcohol rather than from the alcohol itself. There may be some truth to that, although the evidence is sparse. So, what is left to drink? The best drink is really just plain or sparkling water. Slices of lemon, orange, or cucumber are a refreshing addition. Several traditional and delicious drinks are also available as described hereafter. Coffee, healthier than we thought. Due to its high caffeine content, coffee is sometimes considered unhealthy. However, recent research has come to the opposite conclusion, perhaps due to the fact that coffee is a major source of antioxidants, magnesium, lignans, and chlorogenic acid. Coffee, even the decaffeinated version, appears to protect against type 2 diabetes. In a 2009 review, each additional daily cup of coffee lowered the risk of diabetes by 7%, even up to 6 cups per day. The European Prospective Investigation into Cancer and Nutrition study estimated that drinking at least 3 cups of coffee or tea daily reduced the risk of diabetes by 42%. The Singapore Chinese Health Study showed a 30% reduction in risk. Coffee drinking is associated with a 10% to 15% reduction in total mortality. Large-scale studies found that most major causes of death, including heart disease, were reduced. Coffee may guard against the neurologic disease Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, liver cirrhosis, and liver cancer. A word of caution here, while these correlation studies are suggestive, they are not proof of benefit. However, they suggest that coffee may not be as harmful as we imagined. Store beans in an airtight container away from excessive moisture, heat, and light. Flavor is lost quickly after grinding, so investing in a reliable grinder is worthwhile. Grind beans immediately before brewing. On hot days, iced coffee is simple and inexpensive to make. Simply brew a pot of regular coffee and cool it in the refrigerator overnight. You can use cinnamon, coconut oil, vanilla extract, almond extract, and cream to flavor your coffee without changing its healthy nature. Avoid adding sugar or other sweeteners. Tea time, anytime. After water, tea is the most popular beverage in the world. There are several basic tea varieties. Black tea is the most common, making up almost 75% of global consumption. Harvested leaves are fully fermented, giving tea its characteristic black color. Black tea tends to be higher in caffeine than other varieties. Oolong tea is semi-fermented, meaning that it undergoes a shorter period of fermentation. Green tea is non-fermented. Instead, the freshly harvested leaves immediately undergo a steaming process to stop fermentation, giving green tea a much more delicate and floral taste. Green tea is naturally much lower in caffeine than coffee, making this drink ideal for those who are sensitive to caffeine stimulant effects. Green tea contains large concentrations of a group of powerful antioxidants called catechins. Notably, one called epigallocatechin 3 gallate. Catechins may play a role in inhibiting carbohydrate digestive enzymes, resulting in lower glucose levels and protecting the pancreatic beta cells. Fermentation, black tea, changes the catechins to a variety of theophlavins, making the antioxidant potential of green tea and black tea comparable. Polyphenols in green tea are also believed to boost metabolism, which may aid in fat burning. Many health benefits have been ascribed to green tea consumption, including increased fat oxidation during exercise, increased resting energy expenditure, lower risk of various types of cancer. A meta-analysis of studies confirms that green tea helps with weight loss, although the benefit is rather modest, in the range of about 2 to 4 pounds, 1 to 2 kilograms. Studies, including the Singapore Chinese Health Study, showed that tea drinking reduced the risk of type 2 diabetes by 14 to 18%. All teas may be enjoyed both as hot or cold beverages. There are infinite varieties of tea available to suit any taste. Flavor can be added with the addition of lemon peel, orange peel, cinnamon, cardamom, vanilla pods, mint, and ginger. Herbal teas are infusions of herbs, spices, or other plant matter in hot water. These are not true teas since they do not contain tea leaves. They make excellent drinks without added sugars and can be enjoyed hot or cold. The varieties are endless. Some popular varieties include mint, chamomile, ginger, lavender, lemon balm, hibiscus, and rosehip teas. The addition of cinnamon or other spices can enhance the flavor. Bone broth. Virtually every culture's culinary traditions include the nutritious and delicious bone broth. Animal bones are simmered with the addition of vegetables, herbs, and spices for flavoring. The long simmering time, 4 to 48 hours, releases most of the minerals, gelatin, and nutrients. The addition of a small amount of vinegar during cooking helps leach some of the stored minerals. Bone broths are very high in amino acids, such as proline, arginine, and glycine, as well as minerals, such as calcium, magnesium, and phosphorus. Animal bones are often available at ethnic grocery stores and fairly inexpensive. They are also very convenient, requiring little preparation time. They can be made in large batches and frozen. Most commercially prepared broths have nothing in common with the homemade variety. Prepackaged broths often rely on artificial flavors and MSG to provide taste. The minerals, nutrients, and gelatin are not present in many canned broths. Step 2. Reduce your consumption of refined grains. Refined grains, such as white flour, stimulate insulin to a greater degree than virtually any other food. If you reduce your consumption of flour and refined grains, you will substantially improve your weight loss potential. White flour, being nutritionally bankrupt, can be safely reduced or even eliminated from your diet. Enriched white flours have had all their nutrients stripped out during processing and later added back to retain a veneer of healthiness. Whole wheat and whole grains are an improvement over white flour, containing more vitamins and fiber. The bran fiber helps protect against the insulin spikes. However, whole grain flour is still highly processed in a modern flour mill. Traditional stone mill grinding is preferable. The ultra-fine particles produced by modern milling techniques ensure rapid absorption of flour, even whole wheat flour, by the intestine, which tends to increase the insulin effect. Avoid processed bakery foods that are mostly flour and other starches, bread, bagels, English muffins, roti, naan-breads, dinner rolls, breadsticks, Melba toasts, crackers, tea biscuits, scones, tortillas, wraps, muffins, cookies, cakes, cupcakes, and donuts. Pasta and noodles of all varieties are also concentrated sources of refined carbohydrates. Reduce these to a minimum. The whole grain pastas that are now widely available are a better choice, though far from ideal. Carbohydrates should be enjoyed in their natural, whole, unprocessed form. Many traditional diets built around carbohydrates cause neither poor health nor obesity. Remember, the toxicity in much Western food lies in the processing rather than in the food itself. The carbohydrates in Western diets are heavily skewed toward refined grains and are thus highly obesogenic. Eggplant, kale, spinach, carrots, broccoli, peas, Brussels sprouts, tomatoes, asparagus, bell peppers, zucchini, cauliflower, avocados, lettuce, beets, cucumbers, watercress, cabbage, among others, are all extremely healthy carbohydrate-containing foods. Quinoa, technically a seed, but often used as a grain, is one of the so-called ancient grains. Grown originally in the Inca Empire of South America, it was referred to as the mother of all grains. It comes in three varieties, red, white, and black. Quinoa is very high in fiber, protein, and vitamins. In addition, Quinoa has a low glycemic index and contains plenty of antioxidants, such as quercetin and kaempferol, which are believed to be anti-inflammatory. Chia seeds are native to South and Central America and have been dated to the Aztec and Mayans. The word chia is derived from the ancient Mayan word for strength. Chia seeds are high in fiber, vitamins, minerals, omega-3, proteins, and antioxidants. They are usually soaked in fluid as they absorb 10 times their weight in water, forming an edible gel. Beans are a versatile, fiber-rich carbohydrate staple of many traditional diets. They are an extremely good source of protein, particularly for vegetarian diets. Edamame beans, popular in Japanese cuisine, provide 9 grams of fiber and 11 grams of protein per serving. Step 3. Moderate your protein consumption. In contrast to refined grains, protein cannot and should not be eliminated from your diet. For more on protein, refer to Chapter 17. Instead, moderate the amount of protein in your diet to fall within 20% to 30% of your total calories. Excessively high protein diets are not advisable and are quite difficult to follow, since protein is rarely eaten in isolation. Protein-containing foods, such as dairy or meat, often contain significant amounts of fat. Vegetable proteins, such as legumes, often contain significant amounts of carbohydrate. Thus, extremely high protein diets are usually quite unpalatable. They tend to rely on egg whites and very lean meats. Needless to say, it's difficult to comply with such very limited diets. Some dieters turn to meal replacement shakes, bars, or protein powders, which are really just highly processed fake foods. Optifast, SlimFast, Ensure, and Boost are only some examples in a crowded marketplace of nutritional thieves. These products don't produce lasting weight loss, and they're designed to keep you hooked on their processed concoctions. Step 4. Increase your consumption of natural fats. Of the three major macronutrients, carbohydrates, proteins, and fats, dietary fat is the least likely to stimulate insulin. Thus, dietary fat is not inherently fattening, but potentially protective. For more about fat as a protective factor, refer to Chapter 18. In choosing fats, strive for a higher proportion of natural fats. Natural, unprocessed fats include olive oil, butter, coconut oil, beef tallow, and leaf lard. The highly processed vegetable oils, high in inflammatory omega-6 fatty acids, may have some detrimental health effects. Widely acknowledged as healthy, the Mediterranean diet is high in oleic acid, the monosaturated fats contained in olive oil. Olives are native to the Mediterranean region, and olive oil was being produced as early as 4500 BC. Ripe olive fruit is crushed into a paste, and the oil is extracted using a press. The term virgin refers to oil that is extracted using these mechanical means only, and is certainly the best choice. Other grades of oil rely on chemical methods and should be avoided. Refined oils use chemicals and high heat to extract the oil and neutralize bad tastes, allowing producers to use second-rate olives. Be aware that the term pure olive oil often denotes refined oils. Extra virgin olive oil is unrefined, contains fruity undertones, and it meets certain quality standards. The health benefits of olive oil have long been recognized. Olive oil contains large amounts of antioxidants, including polyphenols and oleocanthal, which has anti-inflammatory properties. Among its purported benefits are reduced inflammation, lowered cholesterol, decreased blood clotting, and reduced blood pressure. Together, These potential properties may reduce the overall risk of cardiovascular disease, including heart attacks and strokes. Heat and light cause oxidation, so olive oil must be stored in a cool, dark spot. Dark green glass containers reduce incoming light to help preserve the oil. Light olive oils undergo a fine filtration to remove most of the flavor, aroma, and color. This process makes it more suitable for baking, where the fruity aroma is not desirable. Nuts are also prominent in the Mediterranean diet. Long shunned for their high fat content, they have since been recognized to have significant health benefits. In addition to healthy fats, nuts are naturally high in fiber and low in carbohydrates. Walnuts, in particular, are high in the omega-3 fatty acids. Full-fat dairy is delicious and can be enjoyed without concern of fattening effects. A review of 29 randomized controlled trials showed neither a fat-gaining nor reducing effect. Full-fat dairy is associated with a 62% lower risk of type 2 diabetes. Avocados have been recently recognized as a very healthy and delicious addition to any diet. Although not sweet, they are the fruit of the avocado tree. High in vitamins and particularly high in potassium, the avocado is unique among fruits for being very low in carbohydrates and high in the monounsaturated fat oleic acid. Furthermore, it is very high in both soluble and insoluble fiber. Step 5. Increase your consumption of protective factors. Fiber can reduce the insulin-stimulating effects of carbohydrates, making it one of the main protective factors against obesity. But the average North American diet falls far short of recommended daily intakes. For more on fiber as a protective factor, refer to Chapter 16. Numerous studies and observations have confirmed the weight-lowering effects of dietary fiber. Natural whole foods contain plenty of fiber, which is often removed during processing. Fruits, berries, vegetables, whole grains, flax seeds, chia seeds, beans, popcorn, nuts, oatmeal, and pumpkin seeds provide ample fiber. Glucomannan is a soluble, fermentable, and highly viscous dietary fiber that comes from the root of the elephant yam, also known as konjac, native to Asia. Glucomannan can absorb up to 50 times its weight in water, making it one of the most viscous dietary fibers known. The konjac tuber has been used for centuries as a herbal remedy and to make traditional foods such as konjac jelly, tofu, and noodles. Vinegar is also a protective factor. Used in many traditional foods, it may help reduce insulin spikes. Italians often eat bread dipped in oil and vinegar, a prime example of eating a high-carb food with protective factors. Vinegar is added to sushi rice, which reduces its glycemic index by 20% to 40%. Fish and chips are often eaten with malt vinegar. Apple cider vinegar may be taken diluted in some water. The last piece of the puzzle. There are 5 basic steps in weight loss. 1. Reduce your consumption of added sugars. 2. Reduce your consumption of refined grains. 3. Moderate your protein intake. 4. Increase your consumption of natural fats. 5. Increase your consumption of fiber and vinegar. When it comes to the question of what to eat, you pretty much already knew the answer. Most diets very conspicuously resemble each other. There is far more agreement than discord. Eliminate sugars and refined grains. Eat more fiber. Eat vegetables, eat organic, eat more home-cooked meals, avoid fast food, eat whole unprocessed foods, avoid artificial colors and flavors, avoid processed or microwavable foods. Whether you follow the low-carb, low-calorie, South Beach, Atkins, or some other mainstream diet, the advice is very similar. Sure, there are particular nuances to each diet, particularly with respect to dietary fats, but they tend to agree more than they disagree. So, why all the controversy? Agreement does not sell books or magazines. We always need to discover the latest and greatest superfood. Acai berries, quinoa, or we need to discover the latest and greatest dietary villain. Sugar, wheat, fat, carbohydrates, calories. Vogue magazine does not carry headlines such as diet advice you already knew. All diets work in the short term, but we've been ignoring the long-term problem of insulin resistance. There is one more piece of the puzzle. A solution found many centuries ago. A practice that has been enshrined in the nutritional lore of virtually every population on Earth. A tradition rapidly becoming extinct. This tradition is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 20. When to Eat. There is nothing new except what has been forgotten. Marie Antoinette. Long-term dieting is futile. After the initial weight loss, the dreaded plateau appears, followed by the even more dreaded weight regain. The body reacts to weight loss by trying to return to its original body set weight. We hope our body set weight will decrease over time, but that hoped-for reduction does not materialize. Even if we eat all the right things, our insulin levels stay elevated. But we've been addressing only half of the problem. Long-term weight loss is really a two-step process. Two major factors maintain our insulin at a high level. The first is the foods that we eat, which are what we usually change when we go on a diet. But we fail to address the other factor, the long-term problem of insulin resistance. This problem is one of meal timing. Insulin resistance keeps our insulin levels high. High insulin maintains our high body set weight. Inexorably, our high body set weight erodes our weight loss efforts. We start feeling hungrier. Our metabolism, that is, our total energy expenditure, relentlessly decreases until it falls below the level of our energy intake. Our weight plateaus and ruthlessly climbs back up to our original body set weight, even as we keep dieting. Clearly, changing what we eat is not always enough. To succeed, we must break the insulin resistance cycle. But how? The body's knee-jerk reaction to insulin resistance is to increase insulin levels, which in turn creates even more resistance. To break the insulin resistance cycle, we must have recurrent periods of very low insulin levels. Remember that resistance depends on having both persistent and high levels. But how can we induce our body into a temporary state of very low insulin levels? We know that eating the proper foods prevents high levels, but it won't do much to lower them. Some foods are better than others. Nonetheless, all foods increase insulin production. If all foods raise insulin, then the only way for us to lower it is to completely abstain from food. The answer we are looking for is, in a word, fasting. When we talk about fasting to break insulin resistance and lose weight, we are talking about intermittent fasts of 24 to 36 hours. A practical plan for accomplishing these fasts is included in Appendix B. The remainder of this chapter will be devoted to addressing the health concerns around fasting, which the research shows us is a beneficial practice. Fasting, an ancient remedy. Instead of searching for some exotic, never-seen-before diet miracle to help us break insulin resistance, let's instead focus on a tried-and-true ancient healing tradition. Fasting is one of the oldest remedies in human history and has been part of the practice of virtually every culture and religion on Earth.